Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Sports Tonight on BSL Radio. Join Rob Shields and Mike Weber as they talk about the Baltimore Orioles, Baltimore Ravens, University of Maryland Terrapins, and more. Be part of the show. Call us at 347-215-8391.
Welcome to Sports Tonight with Rob and Mike. Mike Weber here with Rob Shields. We will be joined by Tucker Blair, our former Baltimore Sports and Life colleague. He's now big time over at Baseball Prospectus. We'll talk to him about, you know, Orioles prospects. So should have a good conversation with him in about 20 minutes. Otherwise, I mean, there's some other things to get into. Terps basketball, huge win against Wisconsin. Rob and I, neither of us are boxing fans, but the Pacquiao Floyd Mayweather fight is going to happen, so that's a big story in the sports world, and various NBA stories with Derrick Rose going down being one of the main ones. So along with that, you have the Nick Markakis situation. Rob, you want to start with the Nick Markakis situation and just some general O's talk here? Nick has basically said, like, not to listen to the BS coming from the Orioles regarding, you know, why basically he did not re-sign with the Orioles, why the contract negotiations broke down. Today he came out and kind of apologized and tried to clear things up, but was, kind of vague, and it didn't really clear things up, I don't think. So he basically did say, he was sorry and, like, about bringing it up and, not that big of a deal type of thing. But it's the major issue is apparently that, the Orioles, reduced their offer, the amount of years on the offer, once they, got more information about the neck situation. Do you want to expand upon that or just say any sort of comments on what you think about the situation?
Well, first of all, the Orioles kind of made it pretty clear what the issue was. So I don't know. I mean, he's almost kind of saying that they're just saying this stuff now, and that's not the case. I mean, we heard about this back then, so this is not any news to any of us. I think he's a little upset that they would lower their offer. You could also make the argument, well, you didn't agree to the offer that they had originally had on the table, which was apparently a four-year offer. You tried to get more money out of them, and then they found out of an issue. So, I personally wouldn't have a problem with it because it kind of drug on for a little while before we even heard about the neck. So I don't have a problem if a team were to say, look, I'm putting this offer on the table. You have 30 days to accept it, and if not, we're lowering it because we're not going to continue to sit out there and let you use our offer against everybody else. So I wouldn't have a problem if they did that even if there was no injury issue. But the fact that there was... really, what I question is if you're the Orioles, if you were that worried about the neck, why did you even leave 3 years on the table? I mean, if this is something that you're truly worried about, I don't know why you didn't just withdraw the offer, at all. But the other thing is that, Nick still got a contract that was, he couldn't have been upset by the deal that he got offered by any stretch. I mean, I don't... all players think they're probably underpaid, but I mean, he got, in the eyes of most people, well more than fair contract. So it's not like the Orioles put out some information about his neck that wasn't true and that drove his price tag down. So I don't really quite know what his real issue is here. I just think at the end of the day, he wishes that he was still here and he's just a little frustrated and, He was. You're right. He wasn't really clear in his apology that he had in the conversation with Rock. But I one thing I had said is we don't know what kind of context the question was actually asked, and what part of the quote was shown. And it does appear that it was might have been taken a little out of context for what he was trying to say. But I don't know that he cleared up what the context really was. But I don't have any problem, and I don't want any. I hope Oriole fans don't come out and say, oh well, it's sour grapes. Blah, 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 kind of bash Markakis. I mean, if he's asked a question and he feels that the Orioles, didn't do things correctly. I mean, I don't have a problem with him speaking out. Obviously, Adam Jones felt that way, and Jones is seemingly close with Nick, so, you know, he might have had some kind of, you know, inside, you know, information about stuff. So, you know, who knows? But I think at the end of the day, Markakis can't really be that upset because he ended up getting a more than fair deal. I just think he wishes that he had gotten it with the Orioles because I don't think he really truly wanted to leave, but it was too much of a difference in salary to pass up.
Agreed. And, you know, even if this is sour grapes, I'm not going to, you know, really hold that against him. You know, he spent, you know, many years with the Orioles, a lot of productive years, was obviously a part of this renaissance of the Orioles this past three seasons. And, you know, he was a good, you know, model Oriole, basically, during his time here. So if he has a little sour grapes, then, you know, I'll be perfectly forgiving of that. No problem at all. If I happen to be at any of the games when the Braves visit Baltimore in, I believe, late July, then, you know, I'll give him a standing O. No problem at all with that. So, you know, yeah, it is vague. I'm not really sure exactly what his complaint is. But regardless of what it is, I'm not going to hold that against Nick. Maybe there could be some things you could potentially hold against the Orioles. But, you know, we would have to have things cleared up, really, to understand what those things would be. But yeah, like you said, from what we know, I don't really have an issue with how the Orioles handled the situation in terms of, you know, why offering them a contract at all if they have an issue with the neck. Well, I guess, you know, maybe, you know, their risk analysis was basically to the point where they were still comfortable with giving a certain level of years and money, but obviously they had a line there. And, you know, that can make sense depending on the severity of the injury, how likely it is to cause problems and so on and so forth. But, you know, I don't know all the factors that went into that decision, obviously. But, yeah, no ill will towards Nick from my end.
Yeah, I mean, the next thing also isn't new. I mean, you know, he had, I think it was last spring, not this past spring training, the spring training before, I think, is when the neck issue cropped up, I think is when it was. You know, so that there, we had speculated that, you know, is the power decrease that he has seen, did the neck have something to do with that? I believe it was it actually might have been 2012, because I believe that was, you know, he came back and then he really ended up having a really good year. And then Sabathia, you know, he got hit by that pitch. So he showed some power even after that. But I think, you know, I don't know if it's a degenerative nerve type thing or what, but, and maybe he aggravated it when he crashed into the wall against the White Sox in late August of last year and then he kind of just had like a terrible September before having a pretty decent October. But I just wonder if it's kind of a condition that, you know, is going to continue to zap the power even after getting surgery. I mean, a neck is very similar to a back where you really don't know what to expect out of it, especially when you've got bulging discs and things like that. It's, you know, you can have surgery, but, you know, it can be a problem, you know, that much longer after surgery, you know, and then because you've removed part of the disc, then you have, you know, you only have so much disc left, and then, you know, if that bulges more, now all of a sudden you have to have fusion and all that kind of stuff. So it can become a real nightmare of a situation. So I think that, you know, the Orioles, I think they had right to lower their offer when they heard about it, if they were genuinely worried about it. I'm just surprised they only lowered it 1 year. Maybe if it was a different player and somebody that didn't mean as much to the organization, they would have taken it off the table. But I think even the contract that they offered, if they were that worried, was a big risk.
Yeah, potentially. And I agree with what you're saying there at the end. If that was like Melky Cabrera they were negotiating with and they discovered a similar issue, they might have just been like, all right, well, we're out. But with the, you know, long story with Nick Markakis, long background with him, loyalty to be considered, they may have been a little bit more generous at that point than they otherwise would have. But of course, you know, as we saw, the Braves were not nearly as worried as the Orioles seem to have been. All right, so we can get back into the Orioles with Tucker in about 10 minutes, and then potentially after the interview with Tucker Blair about the Orioles prospects. But let's hit on a couple other stories here. First off, like I mentioned, neither of us are boxing fans, but We now have what is seemingly going to be the biggest fight in terms of at least hype of the century, I would think. And, you know, maybe all the way back to, you know, I'm not sure, Tyson Holyfield, I guess. So Mayweather Pacquiao, you know, it's finally going to happen in May. And the problem is, of course, that, you know, these guys are not quite in their prime anymore. Mayweather's still been dominant. Pacquiao's had some bumps in the road, but he seems to have bounced back. So we could have a good fight, but it's, you know, it is always going to be the what if in terms of if they had fought, you know, 4 or 5 years ago or whatever. So any thoughts on this fight here, Rob?
Well, first of all, they're fighting on my birthday, which is great. And, you know, it's a great sports day that day. There's all sorts of stuff going on, NFL draft and the Kentucky Derby. And, you know, there's a couple other, I think, big deal events going on, too. My thoughts are this should have been fought 5 years ago. The fact that it wasn't, I think, takes a lot out of it. And since it should have been fought, these guys have, you know, they've gotten older. They, you know, Pacquiao's lost some. You know, so I think some of the luster is off of this. I don't necessarily know that, like, you know, people have said for a while that Pacquiao is the better boxer. But, you know, at least in the eyes of, probably not everybody, but in the eyes of some. But, you know, if Mayweather beats him now when Pacquiao is out of his prime, does that make Mayweather the better fighter? I mean, you know, that's so tough to say. You know, that's kind of like, you know, when people talk about, like, you know, for example, like Nadal versus Federer. You know, I mean, Nadal, when he was really playing in his prime and was healthy and, you know, playing great tennis, you know, Federer was kind of out of his prime. And it's like, you know, when people will bring up, well, Nadal beat Federer a lot. Well, I mean, he did, yeah, but, you know, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison necessarily. So, now, I don't know. I mean, I actually think Mayweather is older than Pacquiao. I don't know if you would consider one in their prime and the other one out of the prime or something like that. I don't know enough about boxing to comment on that. All I know is I think this would have been a much better fight 5 years ago, and it would have been a much bigger deal 5 years ago. But it's still going to be a big deal, and it's good that it's finally happening just so we don't actually have to even hear about it anymore.
There you go. Yeah, it will be a big deal. You mentioned the Kentucky Derby on the same day. So I guess we're going back to, like, the 50s or something when horse racing and boxing were, like, kings of the sports world. So
the NFL draft will get better ratings than both.
Yeah, well, and so, I mean, obviously the boxing, if it was on free TV, would get huge ratings. Speaking of that, I guess they're going to charge $100 for the pay-per-view. You know, I guess the normal cost is, I think it's up to 60 or so now. There's a difference between if you get HD and standard definition. But, you know, I think it's like $60 typically for like a UFC fight or like other boxing pay-per-views or I guess wrestling pay-per-views that you would, I guess, know about that, Rob. But $100, that's a huge increase. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't pay $50. I mean, I don't even think I'd pay $30. It's not a big deal now. If you know, if a group of people, like, wanted to come, like, you know, if I wanted to have a party that night and everybody wanted to throw in $5-$10 to watch it, I guess I would do that. If people wanted to go out to a bar that was having it, you know, maybe I would do that. Of course, they'd probably, you know, charge you some cover or something, but whatever. But, I mean, if I'm just sitting here, there's zero chance that I would pay anything even close to that to see these guys fight.
Yeah, I'm not paying $100 myself to watch this fight. Definitely not. You know, like you said, if there's like a big group, people chip in $10 each, whatever, cool. But the fight itself, again, I'm not no boxing expert, but from what I understand, this is not, you know, necessarily going to be an incredibly exciting fight. It's exciting if you're like a boxing diehard, you've been waiting to see it forever, but there's good chance no one's going to be even knocked down, nonetheless, mm-hmm. knocked out in this game match. So, you know, tactical battle, lighter weight guys. So, whatever. A good chance I would not actually see the fight. So, we shall see. But let's move on to the Terps for a little bit. Huge win over Wisconsin, 59-53, Wisconsin, top five team going into that matchup. You know, so, you know, Mel had a nice game, 16 points, but Des Wells, who has struggled for most of the season, he's had some injury issues as well. 26 points, 7 boards, 4 assists, shot 9 for 17. So, you know, those two guys really led the team. There wasn't, you know, much scoring otherwise. No one had more than 6 points after those two guys. But huge win, I think, for the program in general. Any thoughts here, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question it's a huge win. You know, I think, you know, barring some just total collapse, which there's not that much time left to collapse, I think they've locked up at least a number four seed, and right now you might be able to argue that they're a three. I know a lot of the bracket people have them as a three. I'm not sure if they would get a three, but, you know, they do have some quality wins outside of that win, so they might have done enough to get a three. But that, I mean, it's a big deal. It's your first year in the Big Ten, and you beat the team. You beat one of the two or probably three teams that have consistently been at the top of the Big Ten, along with Michigan State and Ohio State. And, you know, Michigan State is down this year, so winning at Michigan State in most years would be a bigger deal than beating Wisconsin at home, just because it's a road versus home. Now, you know, a normal Michigan State team, they probably don't go into Michigan State and win this year, but, you know, but nonetheless, that was still a really good win. But it's not as good as this Wisconsin win. This is a potential program-changing win. This is kind of an announcement to the Big Ten. We are here. You know, the Big Ten is down in terms of having elite teams, but it does have some decent depth in it. And, you know, Maryland, they're a year early. And, you know, the question's going to be, the one downside to that game could be that was a little bit more of a national, hey, look at me type game for Trimble. And the worry, I think, for Maryland fans is going to be, does he leave early? Because if he leaves and then you're losing Wells, that takes a little sting off of next year. Same if Jake Layman leaves. I mean, both of those guys are looked at as future first-round picks, but I don't know that they're looked at as first-round picks right now, although teams could still take them based off of potential. So, you know, Maryland fans have seen guys leave early that shouldn't leave, you know, like Jordan Williams, for example. So it wouldn't be shocking. That's the only thing. But, you know, if those two guys come back next year, and then they've got Robert Carter Jr. coming, that they're really poised to be really good next year, like top 10 in the country good. So anything that they're getting this year, quality wins, getting into the tournament finally, and things like that, anything that happens is just huge for them next year. Now, the question's going to be, you know, they're going to be in that 3-4 seed type area, and they're going to play a tough team in the first round. So the question's going to – and they've been vulnerable this year. I mean, Maryland has always been a team that gets up for the big games and sometimes does not get up for the other games. So, you know, when they're playing looking at Duke last year, for example, you know, Duke was a 3 seed. They lost to Mercer. You get a team like that, you know, that is a quality all-around team, you know, does Maryland overlook a little bit like they have a tendency to do and have done over the years? So that's the one thing that I would worry about. Is that first game in the tournament? But you know what? Even if they lost that game, I think Maryland fans have to look at this year as nothing but a positive. It might end in a disappointment, but the year in general, it has to be looked at as a big positive.
Totally agree. I'm not, you know, a huge college basketball fan anymore. I do watch a decent amount of Terps basketball though, and you know, to me, this is not an incredibly impressive squad. I mean, they've done an excellent job, though, in pulling out close games. And, you know, I think that's part of the difference there between their record and their, you know, and their ranking compared to, like, KenPom and other, you know, sites like that that would analyze, you know, your performance without necessarily considering wins, losses quite as much or if at all. So Maryland's 23-5, but they're only 34th in KenPom. And now they're, you know, poised to be, you know, they're in the top 15 or whatever in the rankings. I'm not even sure exactly where they're ranked right now. But this is not a team that, you know, even as a 3 or 4 seed going into the tournament, that I'm going to have much confidence in, even winning the one game, like you said. If they're just, you know, they're still lacking a lot, I think. There's no real post presence. You know, it's been disappointing in terms of Sikorski. He was expected to be a lot better early on. Dodd showed some flashes early on, but hasn't really built on that. And, you know, other than that, you know, yeah, Mel Trimble is a good player. Dez had the big game against Wisconsin, but he's been inconsistent, like I said. You're relying on some youth here, and, you know, it's overall, it's a solid team. And, yeah, anything I think is pretty much gravy going forward. But I would still like at least one win in the tournament. That would be, you know, pretty nice for Terps, for the Terps fans. But I'm not expecting a huge run. But, you know, when you're a 3 or 4 seed, you obviously have a chance to go relatively deep. But with that said, let's transition here. Let's welcome Tucker Blair from Baseball Prospectus to the show. How you doing tonight, Tucker?
Doing all right, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. So, Tucker, of course, former colleague of ours at Baltimore Sports and Life. Now you're over at Baseball Prospectus covering prospects. So you're very well versed on the Orioles prospects. So let's start off with Dylan Bundy. What are your expectations for him this season?
You know, I've seen a lot of Dylan over the past couple years. And from everything I saw last season when I saw him at Aberdeen and Frederick, and from everything I've heard, he should be good to go this year. I don't expect any setbacks. You know, Buck has already come out and said that he's likely slotted to start at Double-A Bowie, which I think is appropriate for the amount of time he missed. And really the only thing that we're looking for is if the velocity comes back, if it gets that final tick that he was missing last year. But I think the concern and the worries regarding Bundy have started to subside a little bit. And I think it's important for us to remember that he doesn't need to be rushed. The Orioles don't exactly need him right now. And I think with the timeline that the Orioles have set, Bundy is going to be just fine. And I wouldn't worry about him. He's very good, but it remains to be seen whether he's going to be good or great.
All right, so that's good to hear. So you mentioned, you know, starting in Double A. What type of workload are you expecting him to go through this season?
I think if you look at what the Orioles have done in the past with certain injuries, for example, Tim Barry, Tommy John guy, they took him pretty slow coming back. And also when Bundy first came in to the system, the Orioles had him on that five-inning stint, and that's kind of what I see him making a ton of five-inning starts, at least at the beginning of the year. Maybe they'll push him once he gets his innings under his belt, but I don't expect the Orioles to push him very hard because, like I said, they don't really have a need for him right now with their logjam of average to whatever starting pitchers in the majors, but Yeah, I envision slow to start, and then they'll pick it up.
All right, so you mentioned the Orioles don't have a need for him necessarily right now, but do you think there's a good chance that he is a contributor for the Orioles at some point this season?
You know, it's tough to think that far ahead, but I think reasonably, yes. I think if the Orioles either are not in it any longer at some point during this season, or they are in need of an arm, I think Dylan Bundy is one of their better options. And there could be a time this season where he is one of their better options regardless of where they currently stand. You know, and it really all depends on how this stuff comes back. Is he going to be 91 to 94? Is he going to have that 93 to 97 again? And, you know, I think eventually he will force himself onto the major league team, and you know they could end up having a similar role that they did with Gausman. Of course, let's hope they don't yo-yo Bundy. But
we hope he's not yo-yoed. But would you be okay with him if the Orioles decide to use him in the bullpen later in the season if they need a good bullpen arm?
I think so, and I a lot of it is because he does have that major league option, that major league contract, and essentially they are forced to have him on the major league team eventually. So if he's not going to get time this year, you're going into next season with a big question mark, and you really are forced to have him learn on the fly when Dylan Bundy in the bullpen right now would be an above-average reliever. I have no doubt in my mind about that. So if they have a spot later on, and, you know, it could be a September call-up, that's better than anything else they have. So I think the experience alone would be beneficial, even though it might not necessarily be his long-term status as an Oriole if he's put in the bullpen.
So, Tucker, moving on to the other top pitching prospect the Orioles have, Hunter Harvey. What are you hearing about his prospects of being able to stay healthy with that elbow?
I've heard he's fine. I think the Orioles were very precautionary last year. And, you know, if Hunter Harvey didn't nail, he was probably going to be put on the disabled list. So I wouldn't really worry too much about that. I think it was concerning, obviously. You know, anytime you hear about an arm injury with a pitcher, the red flag is immediately waved. But from everything that I've read and I've talked to, he should be good to go, and there's no concerns at this point. His delivery has always had a few quirks. He does have a little crossfire in his delivery, which, you know, it's not the best thing in the world for a arm, but I don't really have any other issues with Harvey in terms of his long-term stability. So I wouldn't worry about it right now. I think he's good to go as well. I think the Orioles were more safe than they really need to be almost, but that's never should be a concern with a young pitcher.
Does it bother you that apparently this spring training he's been throwing some splitters, since that does put a lot of stress on the elbow, or is that something that's not a concern to you?
I'll be honest with you. I don't have enough information. You know, there's obviously, I think there was a piece in, I want to say New York Times or whatever, that had that the splitter causes some issues with arms down the road, and it makes sense when you think about how much pressure is put on the fingers and the hand when you are using the splitter grip, because it's very unnatural. You know, there's been pitchers that have pitched in the majors for 10-plus years with the splitter, so it really depends. I don't have a good enough answer there to really pinpoint whether it's going to be an issue. But if it can help him down the road become a better pitcher, I'm all for it.
And last question on him, do you think, assuming health, do you think it's too much to think that he could hit the Double-A this year?
That's a good point, actually, and I thought about that a little bit. It depends on two things. His durability, because last year with Harvey, he would trail off in the fourth and fifth and sixth innings, and that's natural. He's never thrown that many innings in his life. And the changeup. In high school, Hunter Harvey did not even need to use his changeup. I mean, most high schoolers can't hit 95 miles per hour anyway. So I think it really remains to be seen about the development for those two pitches, because you know, Double-A is a big jump. And once you get to Double-A is when you start to see some guys that have, you know, they've been around the block. You got the 26-year-old, the Newman Romeros of the world that have seen time in the majors, or you know, they've been around enough as a minor league vet that they're going to hit, you know, they're the guys hitting 300 with 25 home runs in the Eastern League. And that's a big jump for a young pitcher. And I don't like rushing guys to Double-A, but, you know, if Harvey's destroying the Carolina League, I think it's not unfair to push him.
All right, Tucker, so there's, you know, more of a debate in terms of third prospect for the Orioles. Who is the third best prospect in your mind?
I don't even think it's a debate, honestly. I think Chance Sisko is by far the third best. You know, Sisko, it depends on the defense. I'm not sold on him sticking as a catcher. He's an athletic guy. He played shortstop in high school. But sometimes athleticism just doesn't correlate to catcher skills. And his feet, while he's an athletic person, they don't always you know, move as quickly as I'd like them to behind the plate. And obviously, as a guy that hasn't caught a ton in his career. He has some issues with pitch framing and his throwing mechanics to second base on steals were a constant issue for me last year, but there was a little bit of growth throughout the season. But the hit tool and the bat, moving forward, I think he's going to hit wherever he is. And if Cisco ends up as a third baseman, second baseman, left fielder, he's going to be a productive hitter in my eye. And I think it's hard for me to not say he's the third prospect in this system. And, you know, at Baseball Prospectus, we did have him as the 101st guy on our list. And, you know, me, Nick Falaris, Chris Mellon, we all agreed he's one of the top 101 guys in baseball. And the only other guy, I guess, that would be even in that discussion, or maybe two guys, would be Christian Walker and Zach Davies. But they both have their own flaws. You know, Zach Davies is very small. And, you know, the Tim Lincecums of the world have always not been sexy prospects in the eyes of scouts. And, you know, he has good stuff for his size, but there's enough skepticism there that we just don't know. And Christian Walker is the same thing. I mean, high floor guy, you know, might be a 270, 10 to 15 home run guy in the majors, but as a first baseman, that's just not terribly valuable.
All right, so, you know, good thoughts there. Just going back to Chan Cisco, what kind of hitter do you project him to be?
I think Cisco's a guy that has the potential to be a high average guy. I think, you know, anywhere from 280 to 300, and I think the power is going to come around eventually. When I saw him last year in spring training, he was hitting line drive after line drive. When I saw him, I think it was about June, when I went down to Delmarva in Salisbury, he was putting a little bit more backspin on the ball, using the entire field a little bit more, and he just looked a little bit more comfortable, and the power started to come around a little bit. And, you know, I could see Cisco being a 280, 300 average guy, maybe 10 to 15 home runs, and as a catcher, that's really valuable. And even as a second or third baseman, it's not terrible.
Tucker, we want to ask you about a couple other guys, but as somebody who's around the minor leagues of the Orioles, maybe more than anybody, I assume you've seen coaches and things and seen the way that they do things. Over the last few years, the Orioles have had guys that have come up and defensively not had the best reputations from scouts, whether it's Caleb Joseph or Scope or, you know, even going back to Matt Wieters and all. Are the Orioles, are you seeing anything that the Orioles are teaching down in the minors in terms of defense that is, when they get up to the majors, is something that these guys are taking with them and they end up much better than what the scouts are talking about?
You know, I don't really have anything that stands out, but I will say this about Caleb Joseph. The Orioles, in the minor leagues, they do work on simulating some pitch framing and certain catcher skills of that nature. And I think that does trickle up to the major leagues. And I don't think it's any secret that Showalter is a fan of catchers that have good pitch framing skills, as Caleb Joseph was surprisingly very good at that last year. And I've never really been a huge fan of his defense, but I think a lot of that is attributed to him playing every day in the minor leagues. He just wore down. And that's what I saw always. And I think once he got to the major leagues, you know, not playing every day actually helped him. But going back to, you know, little drills or anything of that nature, the only one that really comes off the top of my head is I have seen the Orioles working on pitch framing skills, which it's difficult to do, but essentially it's just like a coach is simulating throwing on the corners and just having the catchers work on it.
Okay, moving to another prospect, the guy that I haven't seen him, but based off of different stuff that I've read and everything, is Connaughton. So what are your thoughts on him, and do you think he's going to stick with baseball? Because there is some talk that, you know, NBA scouts like him and that he might look into going into basketball instead of baseball.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy. I saw him pitch for Notre Dame before he was even drafted by the Orioles, and I was intrigued then. And then I saw him pitch with Aberdeen as well. It didn't go well, but, you know, he hadn't played baseball in like a couple months, so it wasn't that huge of a concern. But Connaughton, I really like him, actually. I think he has good stuff. It's just a difficult scenario because this is a kid that has already come out and said he would love to play basketball now. And the Orioles have already signed him and given him a lot of money, so that's already – his development with the Orioles is already going to be pushed back. I mean, I'm not a big basketball guy, but I'm assuming that Notre Dame is at least going to make some tournament, and that's likely going to push his time with the Orioles back even more. But if the Orioles can get him away from basketball, which they obviously think they can, this is a guy that has a plus fastball, plus curveball potentially, and average to above average changeup if he can be a little bit more consistent with his arm action. But it's a prospect, definitely. It's one of the most exciting guys in this system, which I guess isn't really saying a lot, but the Orioles system is full of a lot of intriguing guys rather than super high ceiling guys.
If he chooses basketball, do you think that that's kind of a slight that the Orioles should have known that and not drafted him and given him the money, or would this kind of be a surprise that he chooses basketball and you can't blame the Orioles for that?
I think it's a little bit of both, because if the talk back when the draft was occurring was that Connaughton, there's no way he's going to play basketball. He's just not good enough. And, I know the Orioles weren't the only team that were very interested in him. In fact, at that game that he pitched at College Park, there was at least 40 scouts there. Stinnett was also pitching as well, which is also – he was another very good arm. But, I think the Orioles also should have known going forward that this is something that they were jumping into, and it's hard to fault them because – Connaughton, he was definitely – he could have been a first- or second-round pick, in my opinion, if he was fully sticking with baseball. But, the Orioles took a gamble, and it remains to be seen whether it works out for them.
All right, Tucker. So, Mike Wright, do you think he's a starter or a reliever?
I think he's a reliever. I like him as a reliever. I think it's 95-plus. The only thing that really concerns me is his fastball can be a little bit straight, and the slider and the changeup aren't really difference makers. And I kind of view Mike Wright as a miniature Tommy Hunter-style pitcher. He can pump the fastball, but if he's not locating it, it's going to get hit. And I think he's a good pitcher, and I think the Orioles are going to keep him in the rotation, but I don't envision him ever getting a shot in the rotation. And it's odd because he's a durable guy, but like I said, it's another Tommy Hunter-style pitcher that has a lot of things that work as a starter, but the best fit is the bullpen.
So you think the Orioles are making a mistake by – maybe being too stubborn with sticking him as a starter?
No, I don't think so, because you can always move a guy to the pen, whenever that is. It's more difficult that moving him back into the rotation once you've already made that move. And, there are other people that believe he still can start, and I know for a fact that there are a few within the Orioles organization that do think that. And while I don't agree, I don't fault them for keeping him in the rotation for as long as possible.
And excuse me, sorry. And Tucker, I'm just curious. What are your expectations at the major league level for Jonathan Scope this year? How much advancement do you see with his bat? And do you think that his defense can continue to be at the high level that it was last year?
Yeah, I think the defense is going to be the same. I was always impressed by his defense in the minors. And in fact, he only got better as he got to the majors. But the bat, I always thought that Scope was a little bit rushed, and I don't think anybody would disagree there. It was blatantly obvious that Scope wasn't quite ready for the majors. I don't know how easy it is for him to learn on the fly like that. I don't really envision him being significantly better than last year, which is probably one of the reasons they brought in Tavares Cabrera, because, you know, Scope, is he going to be at the next level? I don't really know. I don't know if he is going to take his game and drastically improve it enough for the Orioles to not be, I wouldn't say concerned, but obviously Scope, outside of the occasional home run, was a black hole in their lineup.
All right, Tucker. Thanks a lot for the time. A lot of good thoughts from you. Where can you be followed on Twitter, and what do you have going on right now?
You guys can follow me on Twitter at Tucker Blair ON, and you know, we just kicked off the off season. We have all of our top 10 lists, our top 100 list, the top 101 list at Baseball Prospectus, and it's almost time for spring training. I'll be out in Arizona covering West Coast teams this year for a change, and got some amateur stuff I'll be covering soon, so you can keep an eye on for that, and appreciate it, guys.
Yeah, we appreciate the time, Tucker. Enjoy your time out in Arizona, and have a great night.
Absolutely. You too.
Thanks. All right, some good thoughts there from Tucker Blair. Any main takeaways there, Rob?
You know, the stuff about Cisco, you know, that seems to be kind of what people are saying. I'm surprised. The one thing I forgot, it just occurred to me, I would have liked to have heard, I can't remember if it was, what's one of the scouting services and all were kind of questioning whether his bat will carry over. I don't know if it was Keith Law or who it was, but they were questioning his hit tool, which they're the only ones I've ever heard question it, because it seems like that should be, you know, pretty good. And then the Connaughton thing is, that's a very intriguing guy to me. I had him as, I think our sixth best prospect, which I think is really aggressive compared to what most people are having him at. But, I mean, you know, I think Tucker's point is pretty valid, and I remember hearing that when he was drafted, that he could have been a first or second round pick. Personally, if the Orioles knew for a fact that he was going to play basketball, then I don't think they should have drafted him. If it was something where it was likely he was going to play baseball, but there was a chance he could play basketball, then I'm glad they took the shot at him. Because if you truly believe that he's a first or second round talent and you get him, I believe they got him in the fourth round. So if you get him at that point, that's great value. And, I mean, look, I've watched the guy play basketball. He's a good shooter. He's got decent size and all. He's pretty athletic, but I just don't know that I see NBA player there, but, you know, maybe. But I think his chances of becoming a pro baseball player and one that sticks are better than him becoming a pro basketball player, unless you want to consider the D-League as pro basketball player. So, or if he goes overseas or something, maybe he would prefer to do that. But that's a guy that I'm really interested to see. And then what Tucker said, you know, the main takeaways are Bundy and Harvey. I mean, these are two guys that, you know, the Orioles really have to rest on. I'm glad to hear that Tucker's hearing good things about Harvey. Hopefully that take is what he's heard is the case, and it's not, you know, an over-optimistic way. And I don't mean Tucker over-optimistic, you know, looking at him. I mean, like, you know, people, you know, around the Orioles and all that just are, you know, kind of being a little too optimistic about it. Hopefully that he really is just fine. And, you know, and things are going to be really good with him, because if he is the talent that he showed and he stays healthy, I do expect him to end up in Double A, which is why I asked Tucker that question. I don't think it's a far-fetched thing to think that Harvey is a guy that has a chance of making the 2016 rotation in the second half of the season if we need him and we want to bring him up, and then ready to go in 2017. I don't think that's an unrealistic timetable, as long as his arm stays healthy. So I think those two, and then I definitely, you know, you asked the question about Bundy and will he make the Major League roster this year. I if he's healthy, he's on the team at some point this year. I don't think there's any question about it. I mean, unless he's just really pitching poorly, but I don't see the scenario where Dylan Bundy is healthy and pitching poor enough to where you don't bring him up to the majors, even if it's just in the bullpen. So I'm fully expecting that. It wouldn't surprise me if it happened in June as opposed to July or August or September. But, you know, a lot of that's going to depend on how many innings he's thrown and you know, how he's looking. But it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, he didn't have the Tommy John surgery. He's not coming off of that. He's coming off of just the lat strain that he had at the end of last year. So, you know, he's now another year removed from the Tommy John surgery. So while he's going to be on an innings limit, he's still kind of a go in terms of, you know, when he shows he's ready, there's no reason to leave him down. So I'm looking forward to seeing how he looks in spring training and then, you know, in the early part of the season.
Yeah, definitely. He's, you know, definitely a wild card for the Orioles this season. You know, another big factor, obviously, in terms of when he lands on the Orioles 25-man roster, assuming he does, will be, of course, injuries and, you know, if anyone's struggling, that type of thing. Because the Orioles are, you know, pretty deep on pitching. But, you know, he has a high ceiling, so he could, if he's really lights out down in the minors, could end up, you know, taking someone's spot that's, you know, pitching just okay, whether that's in the rotation or in the bullpen. But, yeah, certainly, even if, like, there's, you know, no real injury issues or struggles to speak of that are significant, you know, I would think he'd at least be up when they expand the roster in September. All right, so any other thoughts on Tucker had to say, or the Orioles in general, Rob?
We didn't get much into he mentioned Christian Walker. We didn't get much into Walker with him, but I think he's another intriguing guy to watch this year. I don't really mind too much if Christian Walker is, you know, a 280-ish hitter and only hits 15 home runs at first. That doesn't bother me. What he'll need to do is be able to play solid defense, get on base, and, you know, and can he hit a bunch of doubles? That's the type of hitter that I think that he can be. And, you know, for at least the first, you know, 4 years of his service time up here, making next to no money, that could be a valuable player that you can win with. So I'm very curious to watch his development this year.
I agree that, you know, power isn't everything, even at first base. You know, but it is important generally to get solid overall offensive production. So that could be, you know, what you typically see from like a Chris Davis type, or, you know, more batting average on base percentage base like a John Olerud, or going back all the way to Keith Hernandez. You know, so I just would like to, you know, see a decent bat overall. It doesn't really matter that much if it's power-based or not. You know, but, you know, with the Orioles having, you know, some strengths, you know, at other positions that aren't necessarily typically as strong offensively, you know, like center field, third base, hopefully with Manny, shortstop, J.J. Hardy, even though, you know, some decline there likely. And, you know, we probably won't be able to say that with catcher, though, beyond this year. So, you know, it'll be, yeah, you know, kind of a complicated situation depending on what you can expect. Because first base generally is a position where it's hard to get a chance if you, you know, if the teams aren't pretty confident in your hit tool.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the pick when we drafted him. I mean, I remember hearing people, I think there were people kind of saying a Mark Grace type guy. You know, a lot of doubles, can get on base, can take a walk, you know, not going to hit a lot of power. But he seems like a guy to me that I like what Tucker said. He has a very high floor, and there's value in that because he's a guy that you can plug in. He may not give you spectacular numbers, but you can bat him seventh in your lineup, or he might be a number two hitter, you know, but you can do something like that. And a guy, you know, if he can get on base, you know, 350 to 370 clip, he can hit 35 doubles, even if he only hits 15 homers. You know, if he can put all that together with good defense, that's a guy I have no problem starting at first base, especially when he's only making, you know, $400,000 a year, and you can now pour money into other areas of the team where first base is usually an area where you're spending a lot of money. So, and you bring up a good point. I mean, you think up the middle. Now, like you said, catcher, that may not be the case, although, you know, let's see how quickly Cisco can get through those. But yes, you know, catcher after this year maybe won't be quite as strong offensively as it's been, but you mentioned Jones. Scope could be, you know, an upper-level offensive second baseman. I think he has that upside. You mentioned Manny. Hardy, maybe not upper-level offensive shortstop anymore, but in terms of all around. So you have, like you said, you have areas. And then the Orioles also, they've got the young arms, where if these guys stay healthy, you're talking about they really should be set up in the next 2 years to where their rotation should be cheap, their bullpen should be cheap, because they've been spending a lot of draft picks on guys that profile as bullpen arms. So they shouldn't have to spend, like, hardly any money in the pen. So they should have some areas, and they don't have much in the outfield unless Dariel Alvarez is going to be something on the corners. But, I mean, they should be able to put some serious money into this team in some of those spots, because they're going to not have a whole lot of money tied up in other areas if things go right and guys don't get hurt.
Very true. All right, so let's talk a little bit of NBA basketball here. Derrick Rose, very sad situation there. You know, he's been battling knee injuries for the last few seasons, and he's suffered another one. So he's, I haven't seen a specific timetable as of yet, but most likely out for the season. And, you know, this, even going beyond this year, it could just continuously, you know, be a mental issue for him. We saw some struggles mentally, perhaps, with him getting over the previous knee injuries. And, you know, physically, he hasn't been quite the same. I mean, he's still a very good athlete, but, you know, this is the type of guy that relies tremendously off of his athleticism. I mean, he was one of the elite athletes in the NBA, and obviously an incredible athletic sport there. So, you know, it's you know, sad for him, for the Bulls organization. Now, he wasn't really having that great of a season, actually, but it's still going to be difficult for the Bulls to overcome in the short term, as well as the long term.
Yeah, it's terrible. You feel terrible for him. I mean, first of all, like you said, he's not having a great year. I think his field goal percentage is only about 40%. I looked at his stats the other day. I know his PER isn't that high. He's averaging 18 a game, but looking at his stats, it looks like an empty 18 points a game, because the field goal percentages and all aren't good. But the one thing is, first of all, you know, he's still fighting to come back. You know, he's still trying to get a lot of the rust off, even at this point. So where would he have been in 2 months, you know, come playoff time? But also, just mentally getting over the idea of, finally, I've had an injury-free season, so he could go into next year feeling 100% confident about his body. And now, that's not the case. I compared him the other day. I said, you know, can he be Grant Hill? Grant Hill lost, I think about 4 years of his career due to the ankle injuries that he had had. And Hill came back, and he still ended up being a very productive NBA player. Now, Grant Hill, I think if he hadn't had the ankle injuries, would have been a Hall of Famer. And you might argue that he still could be one, because they actually do consider what you do in college. So you can argue that he still might end up in the Basketball Hall of Fame, but he would have been a Hall of Famer if not for those injuries. But he was still able to come back and be a productive player. So can Derrick Rose be Grant Hill? Grant Hill did rely a lot on athleticism and his explosiveness. He lost some of that, and, you know, he worked on his jumper, and, you know, and he became a little bit better of a jump shooter than he was when he came into the league. So, you know, Derrick Rose is going to have to reinvent himself a little bit and whatnot, but I mean, it's tough for the Bulls. I think I heard this morning they've got $42 million tied up in him for the next 2 years. I don't think that they can trade him. I would assume that they would probably try, and maybe some team thinks that if Rose can be healthy, you know, that everything will be fine. Maybe if one of these, you know, teams like your Lakers, and I don't know that the Lakers would go after him, but if they're looking for star power and they're not able to obtain it through free agency, maybe they just try to, you know, shot in the dark here and try to go after him or something. You know, if some team like that tries to do something, you know, the Knicks, you know, something like that, maybe they have a chance to unload his contract. But other than that, I think it's likely that they're going to be stuck with him. And, you know, it's just unfortunate that he just can't get himself healthy. And, you know, he's not going to likely be the player that he looked like he was going to be, because so much of his game is based off of athleticism, and he's obviously going to lose some of that because of these injuries.
Yeah, I think, like I said, I think he's already lost some of it, and we'll see if that, you know, even gets worse after this injury. You know, he's only 26 years old, so this is, you know, very sad. I mean, he won the MVP. I don't think he should have won the MVP, but, you know, besides the point, a few years back in the 2010-11 season, I believe. So, you know, in that season, looking at his stats, by the way, he's shooting just under 41% this year. His three-point shooting is, you know, 29%, so that's pretty bad. But one big difference here, that MVP season, he had basically 7 free throws a game. This season, it's 3.8. And that's really speaking to the drop in athleticism, as well as, you know, maybe the drop in the will to drive to the basket. So, you know, it's usually that type of player. I mean, you see that type of decline eventually. Those guys that, you know, attack the basket a lot, once they get into their 30s, late 20s maybe even. Seen that with Dwayne Wade. But, you know, for a 26-year-old guy to have that type of drop is, you know, pretty striking. And, you know, the Bulls are a pretty slow-paced team as well. So, you know, think about that 6.9 free throws a game, which that he had a few years ago. Doesn't seem incredibly impressive, but it's a little more impressive when you consider the slow pace. So, yeah, he's just not the player he was. You know, he's also only averaging 5 assists a game that MVP year at 7.7. So, he's just not the same player. I think the Bulls, you know, can still be a good team without him, but it's looking more and more like it's a two-team race, really, in the East to me, in terms of who actually comes out of it, between the Hawks and the Cavaliers, who are on fire.
Yeah, that's the way it's looking. And, you know, I'm going to be curious on how people are going to view Atlanta. And when I say people, I know the people around the NBA – view them as a legitimate threat and a real team. But I wonder how, like, you know, the media members and fans and stuff like that are going to look at Atlanta going into the playoffs. I heard discussion, they were talking a little bit about this morning on Mike and Mike, and, you know, their consensus is, well, Cleveland is the better team, but you should not be, but nobody should be surprised if Atlanta ends up winning the East, and it shouldn't be looked at as some shock or some huge upset or anything like that. So I'm going to be curious on how people look at it. Atlanta, I heard the stat this morning. They are 16-4, I believe it is, against the West, and they're 11-3, I think, against the Western Conference teams that are currently in the playoffs. So they're not just beating up on the East. They're playing everybody well. And then you look at Cleveland. Cleveland is really playing at a high level right now. They've been great since they made those trades. Now, we'll see how much they get hurt, because they're going to sign Kendrick Perkins, your best buddy. So we'll see if that hurts them and if they start sucking again. But, you know, it seems like the Kevin Love stuff has been put to bed a little bit, you know, right now. I don't really think there's much there. I'm not sure that there was ever really all that much there anyway. So we'll see. I totally agree. I think it's those two teams. I mean, Toronto is capable of winning a couple of games against one of those teams, I think, in a series, and maybe Washington is too. And who knows? Maybe the Bulls are too, because I the Bulls in the past, it's, you know, you've lost Derrick Rose, and that, you know, they've kind of not been able to overcome that. But I think they can overcome it, although I haven't paid a huge amount of attention, but it doesn't seem like Noah is having the year that he's had either. I don't know if he's struggling playing with Gasol or what it is. But, you know, so that's another issue with them, and their defense just hasn't been as good this year as it has been in the past. So I do kind of tend to agree. You know, we'll see if the Wizards can get going. They've lost five in a row. They're actually in danger of dropping to the sixth seed and having to play Cleveland in the first round as of right now, and I you know, you don't want that if you're a Wizards fan. So, you know, those were the only other teams. And, of course, you know, it looked like Miami could maybe make a run, but then losing Bosch, which is really terrible for him. But losing Bosch, that probably negates their ability to make too much of a run.
Yeah, definitely. You know, the Bulls, with as far as Noah, he's battled some injuries as well this season. Mm-hmm. That's part of his issue. I think Cleveland actually has a pretty good shot at being the two seed at the end of the regular season. And maybe they'll play the Heat. But, yeah, the Wizards probably end up as the sixth seed with the way things are going. They need Beal back, but also a lot of people calling for the coach's head there. So plenty of issues with the Wizards, but I think they're going to be a one-and-done team. I think you probably just have, you know, the teams that are currently the top four, Atlanta, Toronto, Cleveland, and Chicago, making it to the second round, because I still think Chicago will be a solid team. They've been a solid team without Rose before. Jimmy Butler has stepped up his game. They've added some other pieces as well this season. So, you know, I think they're still a dangerous team, a team that, you know, if Atlanta plays them in the second round, they're not going to be thrilled to play them, but I think Atlanta should be able to beat them. And then, you know, it comes down to Atlanta versus Cleveland most likely. And, you know, I'll reserve judgment. I'll watch the rest of the regular season, see, you know, if this Cleveland stretch continues here, because they've been playing some really good basketball since their moves with Mozgov and J.R. Smith especially. So, you know, Kendrick Perkins, yeah, you mentioned him. I think he pretty much sucks, but, you know, I don't know. I'm not really sure what he's going to do for Cleveland. I think that actually helps the Thunder, but it's, I guess he could, you know, he could be useful against certain guys. Maybe if they end up playing Memphis, for instance, in the finals, he could be useful just to throw out there for a few minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's going to have a big role. You know, I mean, they've got enough guys in front of him where I don't think he has a big role. I do kind of agree, you know, you go against some of the teams that have bigger front lines or something, if you want to use him for fouls, if you think he's got a presence on your team because he's been in the playoffs a bunch of times and, you know, he can help out some of the younger players, although I don't know that that's really much of a help in Cleveland. So I don't really understand it. I guess the other thing I don't really understand is that there were actually multiple teams rushing after him, but obviously they feel he's bringing something to the table. You know, one of the things I know you always talked about was the offense that Oklahoma City would run, the up and down and things like that. It was always hurt when you had Perkins on the floor. So I don't know if that type of thing is really going to affect Cleveland as much. But still, I don't want him clogging the lane for Kyrie Irving or LeBron either. So, you know, he's not really much of a help. I just think it might be just a veteran big body that you can maybe spell Mozgov a couple minutes here and there and, you know, use up fouls against, like I said, against some teams that have some size.
Yeah, if he has any significant role, that's a huge issue. Any type of offense, regardless of the pace, is not well-suited for Kendrick Perkins because, like you said, he just clogs up the lane. He brings the only, like, offensive ability he brings, and I'm being pretty serious here, is the ability to set a pick. Otherwise, he doesn't do anything on offense. He's a waste there. You don't even have to guard him, basically, unless he's standing, like, right by the basket. So, all right. Anyway, moving on from the great Kendrick Perkins, who I'm sure Scotty Brooks is devastated to see go. And, you know, Cleveland, by the way, playing the Warriors in a few minutes here. So that's a very good game. Be interesting to see how the Cavs stack up there against the league's best team. I wanted to bring up this analytics thing on ESPN where they like, rated all the franchises in the major sports. Did you get a chance to check that out at all, Rob?
I read what they said about the Ravens and the Orioles. I didn't read everything, though.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't gone through all 122 teams or whatever. So, you know, I just think it's interesting to see the list here. I mean, basically for baseball, the Orioles were considered a believer. So there's believers and, you know, there's all in, believers, one foot in, skeptics, and non-believers. So, you know, there's descriptions pretty much speak for themselves. I think it's kind of interesting to look at, you know, they have the top 10 teams that are, like, really all in, and then the top 10 teams that are non-believers. And I'll just, you know, read the list here, and this is, you know, all the sports here. So for the believers, Philadelphia Sixers are number one. Obviously, they're in a huge rebuilding process here. Then you have the Houston Astros, also in a big rebuilding process. Houston Rockets, Tampa Bay Rays, Boston Red Sox, New York Yankees, San Antonio Spurs, Dallas Mavericks, Oakland Athletics, and the Chicago Blackhawks. So, you know, I don't pay much attention to hockey. But, Rob, that list there, those 10 teams, would you say that's a pretty good list of teams there, organizations?
Yeah, and I tell you, I made the comment, this was discussed on Baltimore Sports and Life. I don't know how, if you can quite be, you know, all in, believer, whatever term that they used, you know, completely all in football or not. But if there was a team that was going to be close, it would be the Ravens. The Ravens are, you know, first of all, you know, Harbaugh has talked about the fourth down stuff and, you know, what their analytics say and all that kind of stuff. But even before that type of stuff, I remember making a comment, this was a while ago, that they had that Moneyball style of drafting. You know, a guy like, I'm going to use Adalius Thomas for an example. Thomas was a big time player for the Ravens for a while, and they drafted him out of, I believe he went to Southern Miss. You know, he was Conference USA Player of the Year, Defensive Player of the Year when they drafted him. He was fourth on their board. He's not a guy that a lot of people had rated highly. It's like a Brandon Williams. You know, went to Southern Missouri. You know, another guy not, you know, did some spectacular things at the combine and stuff, but they took these guys, they take guys based off of production. You know, it's that whole Moneyball thing where, yes, you might do something poorly that scouts really want to see you do well, but let's focus on what you do really well. And the Ravens have seemingly always done that in the draft. You know, obviously they're going to miss on guys just like anybody else would, but more often than not, they are drafting very well, and they really put a huge emphasis on production and performing well. And that goes, I mean, that's right at the heart of analytics. You know, this is not, oh my God, this guy can bench 350. He can do this. He can do that. Yeah, he might be able to do those things, but when we saw him on the field, he produced. And you know that. So I think don't know enough. I haven't looked into enough of the other NFL organizations to know if other teams should be there. I mean, the Packers and you know, put an emphasis on some of that kind of stuff too. But I think if there's a team in the NFL, like for sure, it would be the Ravens because of how they do things. But overall, I think it's a good list.
Yeah. So yeah, the Ravens are considered to be one of the most all-in you could be for football. Football isn't quite as statistically based as the other sports, but yeah, and another thing you mentioned, how well they do with the drafting, and then they, you know, have really done an excellent job in gaming the system to acquire extra draft picks. And you know, some people could just say, well, that's common sense, blah blah blah, and you know, it is to an extent, but it is part of the analytics for the Ravens. But you know, so that top 10 list, I just, you know, for that ESPN came up with, all very successful. Well, there's a couple rebuilding organizations clearly that, you know, they're not expected to be good at this point yet, in the Sixers and the Astros, but a lot of people think those teams are on the right track. And then it's, you know, a list of very good organizations, like, you know, the Tampa Bay Rays, Red Sox, Yankees, so unfortunately most of the rest of the AL East, Spurs, Mavericks, Rockets, very good basketball organizations for sure. The A's is a very good baseball organization, and then the Blackhawks have won 2 Stanley Cups since their GM has taken over. So, excellent organization. Now, the bottom 10 organizations, as ranked by the collection of ESPN people here: the Lakers, the Jets, the Marlins, the Titans, Colorado Avalanche, Brooklyn Nets, San Diego Chargers, Washington Redskins, New York Knicks, Philadelphia Phillies. So, I mean, if you were to compare and contrast that list to the list I just mentioned, you know, I would say that it's pretty clear which side is stronger.
Well, yeah, and if you go back before, like, Duquette came around and stuff like that, the Orioles clearly would have been on the bottom of that list. And the only reason I bring that up is because they lost for 15 straight years. So,
yeah.
Now, not every one of those teams that you just mentioned are perennial losers or anything like that. You know, and you have a team like the Marlins who, you know, they produce a lot of top-level talent in their minor league system. You know, they trade a lot of guys because Jeffrey Loria doesn't want to spend any money, but they still produce a lot of talent, and they have made a lot of trades that have brought in a lot of talent. So I don't you can do it. Look, the best organizations do a mix of both, in my opinion. I mean, that's what you should be doing. You can't just look at numbers, and you can't just look at the physical attributes of the player and that type of stuff. You have to look at everything. At some point, production has to matter. I don't care what your ability level is. If you can't produce at certain levels, what makes you think you can produce at the top level? But I do think that if you're going to choose one or the other, that I would rather be an organization that is more analytical based and stat based than the organization that is more scout based. You know, let's use the Phillies for example. Nobody knows what they're actually doing. You know, I understand that the attendance is important and the money that they're. I get all of that, but I'm talking just from a pure baseball standpoint. They don't have a minor league system. They've got an old team with very little upside. I mean, what are they doing? When they're drafting, what are you looking for? What are you trying to spend your money on? Are you looking at what these guys are actually doing on the field? Do you care? I mean, I can't think of an organization that is in much worse shape all around right now than the Phillies are. Now they could move Cliff Lee and Cole Hamels. I mean, they can make some trades. Chase Utley, you know, if they can make some trades and bring in some young talent, they can turn that organization around relatively quickly. But you know, they're just terrible, and there's no signs that they're going to do anything to make themselves a much better team for the long haul. So it's going to be really interesting to see what they do coming up. But I you know, give me the team. I would rather have a team that is just going to sit there and say, I don't want this guy because you know, he doesn't take walks or whatever the case may be, over saying, well, I want this guy because he throws 97 miles an hour and that makes me happy. You know, if I'm taking one or the other, I'm taking the stats. But you do have to have a healthy mix, in my opinion.
Yeah, healthy mix is ideal. I mean, if you look at, you know, the teams I listed as the top 10 teams there, you know, obviously they invest in scouting and, you know, some old school stuff as well, but, you know, they're at the forefront of analytics. So, you know, the San Antonio Spurs, you know, it's not just like stats for the whole thing, of course. You know, there's plenty of other things that go into it. Now, you know, my thought is, you know, you should be, like, as a professional organization, you know, you should be able to invest a lot in both categories. You know, I think it's relatively cheap to invest a lot in analytics, and it's relatively cheap to invest a lot in scouting, you know, compared to your other costs as an organization. If you're talking about, like, baseball, you know, you can hire, you know, a huge staff of analytics guys, you know, that are, you know, very intelligent and all that, and it's still not going to cost, like, it's going to cost less than, like, you know, the average salary of a Major League Baseball player, I would think. So, you know, just invest in that and invest heavily in scouts. Try to get the best scouts you can. I mean, in the baseball list, you know, like the St. Louis Cardinals were on the, I think they were on the all-in category. And, you know, but they obviously have very good scouts as well. The Rays have, you know, had good scouts as well. So, et cetera, et cetera. It's not just, you know, we're just, like, looking at spreadsheets and everything and ignoring everything else. So, I mean, looking at the baseball list, all-in teams, Red Sox, Cubs, Indians, Astros, Yankees, A's, Pirates, and the Cardinals and Rays. So, you know, there's plenty of there's a lot of scouting going on in those organizations, of course, as well. You know, they're a lot of them are known for producing a lot of good talent, and those are all, you know, at least most of them are very good organizations, and the ones that haven't been, you know, as good of organizations, it's been more recently, you know, a change of tenure, change of leadership there, so you can't completely judge like the Astros or the Indians quite yet. So overall, you know, obviously both of us, you know, are supportive of the analytics more so than a lot of people. You know, we recently had the Charles Barkley issue with Daryl Morey, where he's like, I don't believe in advanced statistics, you know, and then he made a bunch of points that, you know, like basically no one disagrees with, you know, like, oh, it takes talent. Like, well, obviously it takes talent. Like, who's saying it doesn't take talent? So, or like, you know, you have stars, so you're going to win. Well, all right. Yeah. That's again, not something people are really disagreeing with. And, yeah. People, I just think sometimes get, you know, too, you know, stuck on like black and white thinking with analytics. Like, you know, you can be like really into analytics, but also still go with a lot of the old school stuff. There's, you know, just combine it, like you said.
Well, yeah, like we've always said, the analytics stuff uses old school methodologies in a lot of ways. Again, WAR measures defense; it measures base running. Those are two old school things, supposedly. Yet it's now a problem that we want to rate a player based off of his entire overall game, and not just the three triple crown stats. That's what's really funny. I mean, it, you know, you bring up the Red Sox. Okay, so the Red Sox are why have they won so many titles in the last 10, 12 years? Because, number one, they spent their money wisely. Number two, they have built a tremendous farm system. Well, how are you building a tremendous farm system? You're not building it solely off of the idea of looking at the high school and college player statistics and saying that's who we're drafting. I don't need to see him pitch. They're doing it through scouting, through analytics. They're doing it through a combination of everything. And right now, what is the biggest fear about the Red Sox? Number one, they've got a great offense. But number two, they've got an incredible minor league system right now where they can use to go out and get another pitcher or something like that. Now, the one thing that they're, you know, that is a little surprising is that their defense is going to take a hit this year, but they have probably figured, yep, the defense is going to take a hit, but the offense is going to be so good that we can overcome that. That's what I think, that's where like a lot of the analytics stuff could come in their thought process. Well, maybe Hanley Ramirez is a minus 10 UZR left fielder, but you know what? If he hits nine, if he gives us a 900 OPS out there, then who cares? And I think there is some of that thinking with them. So, you know, these organizations that are the best, they're now you know, they're the best because they're using everything. And you know, the people who act like the thing with the whole argument that bothers me is they just think that people, you know, who are in the analytics, they're not watching the game. You know, it's just, well, we're looking at a stat sheet. Well, here's the thing. One, that's not true. But even if it were true, the people who would just be looking at the stat sheet versus the people who think they know what they're looking at with their eyes, the people who are just using the stat sheet are probably going to be right more often than the people who are just watching with their eyes, especially the amateur people who don't really know what they're really watching. They think they know, but they don't really know. So I that's where my problem with the whole thing lies. But, you know, absolutely, you got to have both. That's one of the things that has bothered all of us about the Orioles for years, is they seemingly were so old school, they weren't paying attention to any of that stuff. At least that seems to be coming around more and more, and that's probably part of the reason they're performing well.
Yeah, and as far as, you know, relying on the eye test, if you're just going off that versus statistics, you know, we're talking about the NBA like we just were. I mean, yeah, if you're just talking about one team and you watch all their games, fine, but, you know, for most people, you – even NBA, like pretty big NBA fans, you're only going to see so much of each team. So, you know, it's kind of hard to, you know, have definitive conclusions on all the teams in the league and all the players and so on and so forth. But, you know, I think also people get caught up in too much into like, all right, like stats like WAR or PER and stuff like that. You know, analytics go well beyond that. I mean, with baseball. We're talking about like all the shifts now. That's analytics based. You're talking about in terms of a hitter, how they approach each individual pitcher, not just from scouting, but just, you know, you can see their pitch FX results. You can, you know, see where they like to pitch on different counts and so on and so forth. You can say it again. That's kind of old school based, and it is based off of old school stuff. But now you have more information, and the pitcher can obviously use that against batters as well. And then when we're talking about basketball, I mean, the Houston Rockets, a big thing that they do is, you know, they've used it to change how they play the game. They don't take many mid-range jump shots. They try to get to the basket or shoot threes. And, you know, there's some basic math in that in terms of why it's more effective generally. But you can also just, like, you know, use, like, the shot charts that are much more advanced nowadays than they used to be. You know, like Kirk's Goldsberry does that on Grantland quite frequently and very well. And you can use that either as, you know, for your offense to be like, hey, this is where these guys get better shots, get better looks from. This is where they're more likely to convert their shots. And you can, if your guys know that, that's very helpful. And if, you know, on the defensive side of the ball, if you know what works best for the other team, you know, and this is just, this goes well beyond just if you just have a scout, like an advanced scout, go to watch a couple of games before you play them, like, which is what happens in the NBA a lot. You know, you have all the data, and that's going to just change the way you play. And I don't see what would be wrong with that type of information. And, you know, that's something like the Houston Rockets are very well known for. And when Shane Battier played for them, he was, you know, pretty much all in on absorbing that information and, you know, try to utilizing it to his advantage and to his team's advantage. And, you know, what's the problem with that? I don't really understand.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up advanced scouting. I mean, advanced scouting is telling you what, you know, what is a player's weakness, how are they performing, you know, all those types of things. But a lot of that is, a lot of that still is it's analytics. It's a lot of scouting is purely is an analytical based thing. I mean, first of all, you're analyzing the player, period. So that, you know, it's analytical in nature. But also, it's, you know, you can sit there and say, okay, so and so is, you know, they're performing. You know, if some player is performing at a high level statistically, but as a scout, you're seeing, okay, well, but this team is not doing this, so if you do this, they're going to struggle. That's the type of thing you want to hear from the scouts. That's the type of you know, advanced scouting stuff that's not necessarily analytics. You know, it's just that's a quote unquote old school scouting thought. That's that type of stuff. But it all still, in one way or another, comes back to analytics and stats and what is actually happening on the field and what the production is. So I just don't get the whole hub, you know, all the hubbub about this. You're just not going to be a successful organization if you ignore it. You're just not. It's almost like it's not possible because you're ignoring production. So if you're ignoring production, how can you perform at a high level if you ignore that? It just doesn't. The two things just don't go together.
Yeah, I mean, you can still obviously pay attention to certain types of production as a non-analytical, you know, GM or whatever. I mean, in terms of what we're talking about, because, you know, just paying attention to, you know, like batting average and home runs and RBIs. I mean, yeah, you're analyzing those numbers, but you're not an analytical GM really in the sense that we're talking about it. So you can still consider production, but, you know, again, just, you know, utilize everything. I think a lot of the hubbub or whatever is just because, you know, there's obviously a huge amount of debates. You know, there's been the Trout versus Cabrera debates and so on and so forth. And a lot of people just get upset because, you know, they think people like us are just like using war and that's all we're doing when, you know, some of them are just using, you know, the Triple Crown stats or whatever. So it's kind of hypocritical at times, I think. But, you know, some people just, they haven't gotten into the analytics. They haven't, you know, they don't understand them particularly well. And they don't care to try to learn about them. So it's just like silly stuff to them, I guess. I don't know. And then, if someone like me doesn't know exactly like how to do an equation or something, some people like to, you know, harp on that for some reason, like that would be necessary to like kind of utilize the stat. So I don't know, kind of going off on a tangent here, but it's always a fun tangent. The Charles Barkley situation, and there's been a conversation about that on the message board. That kind of spurred this along with, you know, the posting of those organizational ratings. But yeah, the Charles Barkley thing, Pedro Serrano on the message board talked about this last week when we did the show without you, Rob, on the NBA, just covering the NBA. But it was, you know, he was saying that, you know, you need two stars to win the NBA. So in the NBA, I'm like, so you know what Daryl Morey's doing is old school. All right, but you know, no one, again, Daryl Morey's not disagreeing with that. It's like, I think there's like a ton of straw man arguments that go on with, you know, these like analytics bashers. And that was his whole argument, I think, was pretty much against a straw man. Meaning no one was really disagreeing. But then he's like, oh, analytics are garbage. You're like, well, why are they garbage? But there's also a good article I would advise people to read. I posted on in that thread, the NBA thread on Baltimore Sports Life. I forget the author's name on Grantland, but he wrote a good piece about that and, you know, how it's more potentially just about athletes having issues with any type of writer, you know, kind of critiquing, you know, the way they play. So that's a good piece. But any other thoughts on this, Rob, before we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, I just real quickly, I mean, I think I saw a little bit of the conversation you guys were having, and I think Brian made a really good point when talking about Harden. I think it was Brian who made the point. And it was just kind of like, well, maybe their analytics said, you know what, this is a guy who isn't just an all-star player. He can be an elite player. You know, and now maybe most people thought that. A team that seems to like the analytics, Oklahoma City, obviously didn't feel that way because they wouldn't have traded him if they felt, you know, they wouldn't have picked Ibaka over him and they wouldn't have traded Harden if they felt that he was going to be an elite MVP type candidate player. So I think the exact team that Barkley is going after, you know, wanted the stars that he says you have to have, and they found a star that was undervalued perhaps because he wasn't getting the minutes, so they said, you know what, let's go get this guy because we feel he can be an elite player. So yeah, I mean, look, there's nobody in the league who doesn't think you need you need talent and stars to win in the NBA. I mean, that's just common, but how do the guys become stars? They because of the production, which kind of goes back a little bit to the analytics. So I mean, it's a circular argument.
Yeah, and I made a similar point to what Brian posted on the board on when we were talking last week on the pod. You know, yeah, I think a lot of people did not value James Harden as even a max contract guy at the time. A lot of people questioned that the Rockets would give up a fair amount to get him and give him that max contract. So, you know, there were some analytics that went into valuing James Harden the way they did, and there were analytics in acquiring all the assets that they acquired to get to the point where they were in a position to acquire James Harden. You know, so Daryl Morey, his whole strategy was basically to try to build up assets to get a superstar, and that's what he did. It doesn't seem like it's going to work out in a title this year or probably next year because Dwight Howard has really fallen off with injuries and all of that. But, you know, the plan, you know, worked pretty well. You know, so, again, I don't understand his, like, Barkley's points. And then Brandon Nickel on the board is, like, saying how right Charles Barkley was. But, again, no one's arguing against what he said. So it's not even, like, his points are against analytics at all. Except for the one where he said analytics are, like, worthless or whatever his exact words were. And that's just silly, I think, to say that. So, Rob, any final comment here?
You know, it's getting close to the tournament, so hopefully that all gets – we'll get some excitement with the conference tournaments and all coming up. And, you know, all the conferences, you know, this last, we got 1 week left basically, so we'll see, you know, how teams can go with the seedings and, you know, what kind of position they can put themselves in. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, kind of going back to Maryland, how they're going to be able to finish out the season and how high of a seed that they can get. So, you know, it's starting to become that best time of year for sports with the tournament and basketball and, you know, the baseball season starting and all that kind of stuff. So it's good sports time coming up.
Indeed. Go Terps. Looking forward to some spring training baseball as well. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Have a great night.